We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour, we are very pleased to have as our guest, once again, Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois, and occasionally he's here on the program, and we talk about language, encourage people to call in with complaints if they have them about misuse. We are going to do something a little bit different this morning, and that is we are going to talk about a specific topic, the topic of a new book that he has. It's just now coming out that looks at the technology, that various kinds of technologies that have been used over time for writing, and how people thought about them, and perhaps how those things changed the way people wrote. I'm sure we'll be spending a lot of time talking about computers, but also about other things as well. The title of his book is A Better Pencil, the subtitle Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And one of the things that you will learn in this book is that the pencil initially was not a tool for writers. It was actually a tool for carpenters and cabinet makers, and perhaps though it wasn't very long before the writers said, hey, well, that works pretty good for that, and took it up. And that maybe says something about how new technologies come along. People maybe are a little suspicious. They're not quite so sure if that's a good idea, but it maybe doesn't take very long before people start taking to them. And there are consequences. It does indeed change things. That's really what he looks at in the book. And so if you're interested, you head out to the bookstore and you can find it. And, of course, here on the program, we'd be very happy to have your questions and comments. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, you give us a call. Well, thanks very much.
Great to be here, David.
Being here. I think it's my understanding that you didn't really start out to write a book about computers and typewriters and pencils.
Right. I started to write a book about literacy. And as I researched it, the topic sort of came to me that I had been using computers as my primary writing tool since 1983, when I got my first personal computer. Mm-hmm. And by the time I started working on this book, which was in the mid-90s, I mean, it's been years in the making.
That should be on the cover.
Soon to be a major motion picture, right.
Brad Pitt, I understand, will be playing you.
We're going to try to interest him in the rights to that. Playing me, okay, yeah.
Yes, playing you.
Okay.
They'll have to
I was thinking more of Leonard Nimoy, but...
Oh, well, okay. If you want to go for distinguishment, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And it sort of came to me as I was researching literacy that I didn't have anything really great to contribute to this interesting study of literacy itself. I was reading psychologists and anthropologists, and as well as the education writers, as reading legal texts, historians, all sorts of stuff. And I had nothing to add until I realized that, well, I hope, you know, I'm adding something, until I realized that I was using the computer not just to write up my notes and to type up drafts of outlines and ideas and things like that, but to actually research the topic as the what Dr. House calls the interweb became more and more popular. And suddenly, after reading a couple of books about one about what happened when writing came to England big time in the 11th century with the Norman invasion, and what happened with the pencil as a paradigm for engineering, a book by Petrosky, who is an engineer at Duke, who did this amazing history of the pencil, that somehow the computer fit into this chain of historical technological innovations in communication.
Yeah.
So, as the Brits say, the penny dropped at that point, and I had a topic.
As much as we are attached now to the written word, I think it's interesting.
Yes.
You, in fact, go back to Plato and the Greeks and Socrates and so forth, that as far as they were concerned, they were actually very suspicious of the written word, or in the sense they had feeling that there was a hierarchy, and that there was something about the spoken word that placed it above the written word.
So this is what Plato puts into Socrates' mouth in the Phaedrus, the dialogue, where Socrates complains that writing is not such a good thing because of two things, and the quote that usually people pay attention to is that it weakens human memory, that if we come to depend more and more on the written word, we'll start to forget, and the mind will get flabby. But he says as well, and this is even more interesting maybe, in the long run, that the written word is but a mere shadow of speech. It's a representation. It's speech once removed. It's so it can never do what speech can do. And of course, Socrates was in the business of talking, but Plato was in the business of writing. So there's got to be a little irony going on here, a little authorial irony on Plato's part. But I mean, never says this. I mean, my little joke is that we remember it because Plato wrote it down. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this record. But you know, Socrates criticizes writing as not being interactive. He says you can ask a written text what it means, and all it can do is repeat the same words over and over and over again. Whereas you can ask a person what he or she means. Well, he said he, but you know, he or she means, and they can explain it in different words. They can, you know, try to give you a better example, try to clarify stuff. Speech is interactive. Socrates says writing is not. Of course, that's not true either. Writing is interactive, and speech can be incredibly static.
And I think that isn't there also some sort of implication that of reliability, in the sense that if you tell me something and we're sitting here talking, I know it's coming from you. But if, you know, someone hands me a piece of
who
paper and says,
this?
Dennis,
yeah.
and it said,
yeah.
well, yeah, you're telling me Dennis wrote this, but how, you know,
right. How do I know? How do I know that this is authentic, that this is not a forgery? Sure, there's plenty of forged documents throughout, you know, the history of writing. But we also have developed ways of authenticating texts and trying to figure out whether they're real or they are fake. I mean, the reason we place so much value on the signature is as a document authenticator, that somehow the signature has come to mean to us something like the fingerprint. You know, this is the sign of the individual. In the old days, before people could write, they authenticated their documents, which were written for them by scribes, by affixing a seal to it. So either the lead seal or later the wax seal attached to a document that would show an audience who looks at the seal, this is from the source. This is from the horse's mouth.
Well, how long even at that time, it should say Plato was writing these things down. And how long might it have gone from the point where we only trusted personal communications to the point where we're saying, I want this in writing?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it took a while, you know, and it happens at different points in different cultures. It happened pretty quickly in England, because what happened was with the Norman, the Anglo-Saxons were used to doing business by word of mouth. Now, they certainly had a written tradition. They had biblical texts, religious texts, even some chronicles and records and annals that were written down, but very few people wrote and very few people read in those days, and even through the 18th and 19th century in Western Europe and North America, literacy was low. It didn't really break the 50% mark, I think, till the mid-19th century. But what happened was the Normans were used to doing business by written document. So if there was a transfer of property, if there was a deed, if there was a bequest to be made, if I wanted to give the station a lot of money, if I was a Norman, I would put it in writing. If I was an Anglo-Saxon, I would just tell you that, you know, when I die, you can have all my books and records or something like that. Uh-huh. Of course, there were no radio stations back then.
We would have your vast hoard of gold and jewels,
and so what the Normans brought with them to England was this way of doing business, and they simply said from here on in that's how we're doing things, and so they imposed it. The Anglo-Saxons didn't like it because their initial reply was A, we can't read and write, and B, how do we know you're not just doing this to steal more of our land, which is, you know,
probably what they actually were doing.
You know, it was an early case of regime change, and the Normans did come over and plunder and take stuff back and export a lot of ownership back to Normandy.
We have a caller here. We want to bring into the conversation our guest is Dennis Barron. He's a professor of English and linguistics here at the U of I. His new book just now out. I think I don't know what about a week.
Well,
officially,
middle of September.
Okay. Well, recent. It's still warm. A Better Pencil: Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution. That's the title, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. And if you have question, comment, you want to be a part of the conversation, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There's someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, Dr. Barron, thank you. Oh, welcome back.
Call me Dennis. Yes.
Yes, and you mentioned earlier drafts. I was thinking, because I've been writing fiction I kind of semi-quit my business about 5 years ago. I've been writing short stories and stuff. And I do it on a computer because that's just so expedient. But I was thinking of when I was in graduate school, I used to research. I have an art history diploma from graduate school, and I used to, like, go look at, you know, preliminary sketches for painters, for paintings and stuff like that. And I began to, you realize, like, the Proust collection here at the university, all these, drafts, handwritten drafts of books.
Right.
And I'm looking right now at a book, Raymond Carver's Collected Stories, where about the first two-thirds are the actual published ones. Mm-hmm. And the last of the third of the book is his drafts sent to the to his editors.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, with computers, will drafts disappear? Where the final product, they'll go, well, I don't need all that, just delete it. Because that's sort of what I do, with the exception of leaving notes to myself after when I quit, just stop writing. I wonder if you have a thought on that.
Okay, yeah, this is an issue. In the early days of writers using personal computers, if my own experience is at all representative, every time I wrote a new draft of an article or whatever I was working on, I would save the old one under a different name, and within a week, because I revise obsessively, I would have 40 or 50 versions of the text, and I would have no idea which one was the current one, except by looking at the date, and going through the old ones became I just never did it. So I would just switched to just keeping one version and a backup copy. And so, yes, we lose what I call the archaeology of the text.
Yeah.
You don't see the revisions. You don't see the earlier drafts unless you activate something like track changes on your word processor, which does give you a very difficult to read manuscript if you actually try to read the tracked changes. Or you do something that you can do on Wikipedia, which is that a version of a page, after it has been altered, the old version is stored, and you can track back through every edit on a Wikipedia page. Now, this doesn't work so well with your word processor, but if we move to a kind of cloud computing environment where our documents are stored somewhere in the sky, it might be possible to build something like that into your word processor. I need a speech processor, I think, today. Too much rain has made my voice soggy and my mind soggy. You'd be able to go back to see these earlier versions, these revisions, these comments that readers give you, that the wasteland as edited by Pound, that sort of thing, which has been valuable for literary and historical scholarship.
Well, I also want to ask one thing. I noticed that in Japan, talking about digital, selling digital files like books and stuff. Mm. In Japan, there's this thing where you can sign up for a thing where they'll send you a chapter of a book, mm-hmm. or story every day, mm-hmm. or maybe even a page, and it's like 5 cents a page or 10 cents a chapter, whatever.
Sent directly to your phone.
Yeah, it's sent to your phone, and people like on the subways or wherever the mass transit read them, mm-hmm. on the way. And I noticed that I was reading an article in I think Barron's or something about a year ago, where this one writer who's very popular makes $500,000 a year selling those things. I wonder if you think that will happen now, I mean, with all this Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I think it's starting to happen. I think there are some English publishers that are experimenting with this kind of textual delivery. And if you look at it, again, in the historical context, it's not that much different from the way text was delivered in the 19th century. All of Dickens' novels, well, maybe not all of them, but the ones that I'm aware of, were published serially in magazines before they came out in hardcover. And people waited, for each month or whatever it was for the number of the magazine to come out and grabbed up that particular chapter. And they actually wrote back to Dickens sometimes, and he took the reader feedback into consideration as he proceeded with the writing. So he didn't wait till the book was finished.
Oh,
I think to start publishing it, but cranking it out as you go along, because you get paid by the word in the 19th century, and you need that income coming in.
One other thing, I read in the Wall Street Journal this thing, and publishers are calling a thing called a VOOC, V-O-O-K.
Right, right.
Yeah, I don't know if you read that article or not.
I did, yes.
Yeah, and I find that interesting. That I don't know if it's a real good mix, because when I write, it's more of a I think reading is an interior thing,
mm-hmm.
and it's video and stuff. I mean, you can read a nonfiction article that has about art, look at the painting and go back and read and compare the painting, mm-hmm. to the reviewer, but I'm not sure if that would work or not. But I really appreciate your work. I really enjoy your stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. Dennis Barron is our guest. His new book is A Better Pencil. It looks at various kinds of technologies that are used to write. And ask this question, well, does that change the way people read or, mm-hmm. or write? Mm-hmm. The book is out recently. It's published by the Oxford University Press. You should be able to find it in the bookstore. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Earlier this summer, I had the chance to talk with a novelist who had written a novel about Thoreau.
Mm.
And
I've read reviews of that. I haven't seen that.
It was good. Was good. And one of the things that I learned that I had not known was that the Thoreau family, mm-hmm. they were in the pencil business.
That's right. I've got
In fact, Henry David himself was responsible for making some innovations, mm-hmm. in pencil manufacture.
Right.
Apparently it had to do with the way that the graphite was,
he was
made.
Right. He created a process for separating the graphite, better separating the graphite from impurities, but using something to do with blowing air over it, and so it's probably not very good for your lungs if you're working in the pencil factory. But that was an improvement. There's another story, and no one knows whether this actually came about, that you know how pencils are made, because my students are typically not aware of this, and I learned this from Henry Petrosky's book. What you do is you take two half cylinders of wood.
Mm-hmm.
Cedar wood is apparently the best for pencil manufacture, and you cut a groove lengthwise down each half, And into that groove on the bottom half, you insert the lead, the extruded mixture of clay and graphite, which forms, we call it a lead, but there's no lead in it. And then you glue the two halves together. And then you sand them and paint them so you don't see the seam where they're joined. The story was that Thoreau was experimenting with a very thin drill bit that would drill into a solid cylinder of cedar, and then you could insert the extruded lead into that hole. And I think that never, if he did develop that instrument, it never panned out. They never actually used it for pencil making.
That's, I guess, I would have...
Because the lead would keep breaking.
I would have, yeah, well, I'm yeah, sure that's yeah, right. Yeah. I would have guessed, though, it would have been like, you know, if you were making a gun barrel.
Right.
That you would have the tube of the, you said the cylinder of the pencil, you'd drill a hole, and then you'd...
Right.
And then you put the lead in it. But that's not the way
it works. And I don't know if that's the way, I don't know anything about gun manufacture, but I don't know if that's the way they make gun barrels, by drilling a hole into a solid piece of metal, or they put two pieces
no,
of pipe
I don't
together.
Think they put two pieces of pipe. I'm okay. I kind of think
because otherwise
they
would, the force would drive them
you would
apart.
Have a problem. Yeah, so you'd have gun barrels would be blowing up.
Blowing up right and
right
left.
Right and left.
Which is not a desirable thing.
Not if you're the shooter.
Right. If you're the shootee, then sure.
That's something else entirely.
Yeah. We don't want to get into a Second Amendment discussion here.
So, no, please, let's not. So let's talk then about the pencil.
Yes.
How did the arrival of the pencil change things? Since presumably before people were using some kind of either they
pen.
Would use
they were using
quills
pens.
Or they were using pen. Metal.
No, they weren't. They were using goose quills or... Raw reeds.
So at that point, we still
you sharpen the end. You don't have metal pen points until the mid 19th century in England. They start producing them, and that's when you start eating the geese rather than plucking their feathers. I don't know, but yeah, you're using essentially a goose quill or a reed to dip into ink. And to make marks on paper, you weren't using bits of graphite to write with or draw with. This started to happen in the 16th century, mid 16th century, and apparently, and we're not exactly sure how this came about. So some of this is speculation. Apparently. There's an area in the Cumberland Valley in England which has a very pure graphite deposit that formed most of European pencil use for a couple hundred years till it got depleted. But one story is that shepherds would take these chunks of graphite and notice that they were good for marking things, and they would mark their sheep as a way of kind of identifying them. You know, this is my sheep, not your sheep. Mm-hmm. This is like a brand for cattle. The early uses of graphite were for making molds for cannonballs. I mean, we're back to shooting and blowing things up again. But apparently... The first guys who started using graphite systematically in a holder to mark things up were carpenters and cabinet makers who saw in the graphite a way of marking measurements in wood so you'd know where to cut or drill and without actually gouging the wood. Because before that, they would use
it
all.
They put a scratch.
Yeah, they have to put a scratch in it. And if that scratch is on a finished surface, you have to sand it out afterwards so it looks nice and smooth. But this way, you could just rub out the pencil mark if it showed and was a little easier. And, of course, they had the facility to make little wooden holders to put the chunk of graphite in. But very quickly, and it can't have been more than a few years, and we don't know, the actual progression. I'm just making some of this up. But pretty quickly, writers and artists saw the value of this. I call it, in a way, the first laptop, because what it did was once writers and artists started using pencils, it freed them from the desk and the studio. It allowed them to get outdoors, out into the field, to write or sketch anywhere without having to take all the paraphernalia of writing with you, which would be an ink pot and a few goose quills and a knife to sharpen the point of your goose quill, because you can only write a certain amount before the quill wears out and you have to resharpen it, and after a while you just have to get another quill and go with that. So it kind of made writing and sketching a little more portable.
Yeah. So the one, I suppose, disadvantage, and I suppose the thing that would argue for the invention of the metal pen, is that the pencil mark can be smudged.
It can be
rubbed out. It can be erased. Mm-hmm. So there is the question of permanence, I think.
Yeah, it's a little less permanent, and certainly perceived as evanescent. I mean, we have this myth that writing something in pencil is not legal. A signature in pencil is not legal. That's pretty much not true, except for maybe a couple of isolated circumstances.
I like the story. It's in the book here, and I'm sure you've mentioned it before when we've talked about the fact that in schools, teachers, they didn't like the idea of putting an eraser on the end of the pencil.
Right. Right.
Because they thought it makes it too easy to...
This is one of the responses to a new technology. This is Plato saying it's gonna vitiate your memory. It's gonna weaken your memory, writing. So in the 19th century, one of the big inventions, and we don't tend to think of pencils as technological tools because they have no moving parts and they don't need batteries and assembly is not required. They're pretty much plug and play. All you have to do is keep them sharp. But one of the big inventions, one of the big advances in pencil technology in the late 19th century was that the manufacturers, and this was an American invention, learned to attach the rubber eraser to the end of the pencil using a little metal ferrule. And if you've got your number two pencil handy, there's a couple in the mug here on the desk. This little piece of usually golden, sometimes silver, holds the eraser onto the end of the wood. So some American educators objected that this would allow the children in the classroom to erase what they wrote. Now, the philosophy of education at the time was think before you write, think before you speak. So you weren't to commit anything to paper until you were sure. I mean, this was your final answer. And there was no crossing out. There was no erasing. There was no taking back. And one of the remnants of this that we still have is the spelling bee, where once you say a letter, as you're spelling the word, once you say a letter, even if you suddenly realize, oops, that's not the right letter, that's not the one I meant to say, or I know suddenly, you can't take it back. You're out.
It seems that you
know, but we know who won that battle because you can almost never find a pencil without
an eraser
on it. And in fact, while pencils last long, long time, I mean, you can write thousands and thousands of words with one number two pencil. Yeah. We throw out the pencil once the eraser becomes useless, even if there are several inches of pencil left.
Now, you can't get another eraser to stick on.
You can get separable erasers, and you can get those little tips, eraser tips that you could put on. Yeah. But people just, it's a disposable instrument, but we dispose it not when the lead is used up, but when the eraser is worn down. Yeah.
What's, I think, kind of interesting is that it seems that, I realize this is a jump, but one of the things that I think perhaps people find to complain about with word processing is that the business of writing and revising, it's too easy.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of that, still that extension of that same idea that, I'm not sure.
Let's make it hard for people because we want to discourage them from writing. Well, I mean, there's two things here. One of them is a reluctance to democratize the tools of writing. Okay, a sense that some people have that not everyone should be allowed to do this because, hey, there's a lot of untalented people out there, and if we can keep them away from access to publication, we'll be doing society a favor. Okay? I don't know. That seems to me a little nasty. But the other thing is this. With the computer, you are always looking at clean copy. You've got a typeface, if you're using Times New Roman or Garamond or something else, that the document on your screen and the document that comes out of your laser printer looks like published work. It looks like a magazine or a newspaper or a book page, right? And that's one of the attractions. That's one of the reasons why people went into computer writing, using the computer as a tool, because it allowed them to produce documents that looked like documents they were familiar with. But it also seduces us into thinking that if it looks like published work, then it's publishable. Then it's got the quality of published work. So while it is great for revising because it makes it so easy, I get up after a day of writing at the computer and revising and so on, and I'm much less physically and emotionally wiped out than I was when I was doing all this with typewriters or when I was doing it with a pad of paper. It just seems generally, the whole gestalt of it seems less fatiguing than the old way. But there is a thing that it can lull us into the belief that this is high quality publishable stuff, even though it hasn't been edited by a third party, so I don't have readers' comments yet, and a copy editor hasn't sought out the infelicities of style and the repetitions and all of that stuff that all writers do, and so it's a little easy to say, okay, let's go with this. This is great. And then we come back and somebody says, wait, this isn't ready for prime time.
But you say, but it looks so good.
But it looks so nice, And so maybe a lot of beginning writers are suckered into thinking, well, it looks nice, my teacher will like it, or something like that. You need more than that, obviously. Yeah. There is still some quality control going on.
The guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dennis Barron. He's professor of English and Linguistics at the University of Illinois. His new book is A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution, published by the Oxford University Press, that looks at writing technologies, how they have changed over time, and perhaps how that has affected the way people read and write. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. A caller here in Belgium. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Going back to the pencils. Now, when you play miniature golf or putt-putt golf,
yes,
you don't have...
Don't have an eraser.
There's no eraser.
Yes.
Really short stubs.
Yes, or even, big people's golf. So the places where we have eraserless pencils are... artists don't like erasers on their pencils because artists use a variety of pencil grades to get different shades and degrees of sharpness or smudginess in their lines, and they use several different kinds of erasers to get different kinds of effects. So they keep their erasers and their pencils separate, as I think most European pencils are still eraserless as well. And then you have the golfers. And I suppose, I don't know if this is a subtle message that you don't want to erase the score.
Don't change it.
I don't know. Don't know. It's probably because we use these stubby little pencils for golf, and it's not worth putting an eraser on it.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One thing that I was actually wondering about, you talked about the fact that there are maybe some people now with the spread of the computer and word processing who have grumbled a little bit about that's over democratizing the tools of communication.
Look,
I'm just wondering whether, if you look back in the history of literacy, whether in fact...
Sure.
People made
always.
That same
always.
Or always saying the same
always.
Thing.
You don't want to give the tools of communication and put them in the hands of people who are not qualified to communicate.
The rabble.
The rabble.
People other than me.
The people who are uneducated, of the wrong social class, of the wrong religion, of the wrong ethnicity. I mean, there's all sorts of controls on literacy if you look historically. I mean, this is what I learned in my literacy research. Mm. Sure, but we know this. Anyway, I mean, there are all kinds of controls on publication. There are all kinds of controls on the dissemination of text, whether it's parental in the school, government, religious groups attempting to control what can and can't be put into print, what can or can't be said on the air, what can or can't be broadcast, published, communicated in any way. And we're coming, to the same kinds of questions with the internet. Should there be? What kinds of controls should there be? There's all kinds of bad stuff out on the internet, as well as all kinds of good stuff. And how do we encourage the good stuff and limit the damage that the bad? I mean, there's pornography, there's scamming, there's hate groups have websites. Anybody with a laptop and with a Wi-Fi card and a place to sit at Starbucks is a publishable author, and you can put stuff out into cyberspace. In what way should governments control this? I mean, China has very strict controls on it. A number of other countries have very strict controls on internet access, what you can publish, what you can read. Limits to what you can read on websites became prominent during the Olympics in China, because a lot of Western reporters were complaining that they couldn't get access to the websites that they needed. And the Chinese government promised to lift controls for the duration of the Olympics for these particular folks. But still, it's pretty tight. Other countries like Syria, Iran, Cuba have very strict internet access controls. And in the U.S., there's all kinds of concerns about how to control the internet. But we haven't really come up with a whole lot of solutions yet, other than filters on individual computers and complaints to internet service providers about particular websites, which can then get taken down only if you have control over those providers. I mean, if they're in other countries, we don't have that kind of control over them.
Let's talk with some other folks here. In there, we have two, both in Urbana. First line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Well, I heard the response to the erasers on pencils.
Yeah.
And I just want to make sure, clarify that this is what I think I heard, was that, yes, the erasers on pencils are often sort of bad because they don't really want you to be able, the manufacturers for some reason don't want you to be able to erase, because almost every one of them will make a smudge that you can't get rid of. It's stuck and you certainly can't use it. The only eraser I know is a little separate sort of gray white one that you buy in the art store, which is a soft eraser. It's not gum, for sure.
Right.
It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful eraser.
Yeah, and this is what artists use, one of the kinds of erasers that artists use. No, it's not the manufacturers. It was some teachers in the 19th century in the U.S., their educational philosophy was no correcting, no crossing out. And so they didn't want children to have the tools for crossing out. They also were concerned that the children would eat the erasers, and they were worried about the health effects of, the children were already chewing on the ends of the pencils, and they said, well, they're just going to eat the erasers too now, and you know, this is not so good.
Why are they still so bad?
I think I hear what you're saying. Yeah. The quality, it's brand new, it works pretty well, but I think as it gets, you use it more and more, it just doesn't, you don't get a good clean.
I don't know.
The age? Well, I know they pick up dirt, of course, obviously.
Yeah. Maybe, because they pick up the graphite that they're erasing. I don't know. I mean, pencils smudge. That's part of the technology. And so an imperfect erasure, for most cases, is good enough, I suppose. But
disaster.
Yeah, well, they haven't perfected the eraser. But the thing is that the pencils have the erasers.
Despite the complaints.
I mean, we had similar complaints about technology when handheld computers, calculators became cheap and readily available. The math teachers didn't want the kids to have calculators because they wouldn't learn how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. But then the calculators became mandatory.
Yeah.
You have to have them for math class now. When we introduced computers in writing classes at the university in the later 1980s, some of the teachers didn't want to tell the students that there were spell checkers on the word processing programs, because then the kids would forget how to spell. They'd just use their machines to correct the spelling. Now, and of course, the first day we taught a class, one of the kids said, "Hey, guess what? There's a spell checker on the word processor." And, you know, the cat was out of the bag. And now we complain if the students don't run the spell checker before they turn their papers in. You know, they didn't even have the decency to run the spell checker. That's how little they care about their work.
I got a spell checker between my ears. Well, okay.
All right, thank you. I suppose the moral is, if you want really good erasers, you're going to have to buy a really good eraser.
Go to the art
Go
store.
Go to the art supply store. Exactly. Yeah. To line number two, this is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. You reminded me about 40-some years ago when I started teaching freshman English in a California college. Are you too old enough to remember the blue exam and theme booklets?
Sure, the blue books.
Yeah.
And we call them blue books even yep. after they stop being blue.
Yeah. But the thing that I taught for about 2 years and getting more surly and unhappy with the scrawls that I was collecting. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of things, I found out fundamentally what I was complaining of was my own fault. In my third or fourth year, I said, first day of class, your papers have to be typewritten.
Ah.
I don't care if your girlfriend types it, you mm-hmm. type it, mm-hmm. your mother types it. Mm-hmm. And there was a spell checker, right?
Right.
But they're going to be typed. Because it struck me, on the one hand, we teach everybody to read from a printed page.
Mm-hmm.
And we taught poetry and mm-hmm. the structure of literature from the printed page.
Mm-hmm.
And what in the world were we asking ourselves and people to do to shift some kind of mental brain gear? Because I'll tell you, subjectively, I never really checked. The spelling improved. The paragraphs got longer. And people got more interested in each other's writing.
Once they started typing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and I think the computer's the happiest and best typewriter I ever encountered.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know much more about their operation than that.
Right. That's all you need to know. It's like, you know, you don't need to know how the car works. As long as you can turn it on when it turn the key and it gets you there.
Enjoy the program.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
You've done something. I want to make sure I get you to tell the story that I think is really interesting as an exercise to try to get your students thinking about, you know, writing technology.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
It's the clay tablets.
Right, you're writing on clay.
Writing on clay. How did that occur to you?
Well, it was actually in a seminar on teaching that I taught, and one of the graduate students brought this exercise in and had us write on a little piece of clay. I think she also had us write on typewriters and other unfamiliar or writing technologies, and I wish that person would come forward, because I forget who actually did that presentation, because that gave me the idea. I've been using it in my class ever since. I give the kids 4 ounces of kitty clay, which I buy at the art supply store, and it's a little stick, like a stick of butter, right, like a quarter pound of butter, and I give them a length of 3/4-inch dowel and a little skewer from the supermarket, a little wooden barbecue thing that I, you know, use in cooking for doing skewered shrimp and things like that. And I give them a writing assignment, and I give them some wax paper to protect the desktop, and I give them some little wet naps to wipe their hands when they're done, because this stuff gets all over you. And actually, see, clay writing used to be one of the major ways of writing, right, back in the ancient Middle East, writing on clay. And now nobody uses clay for writing. If the students have had experience with clay, it's been, you know, in nursery school doing art projects. Occasionally I get a sculptor who's done some serious clay work. But it's always art-related. So here's this stick of clay and the writing assignment, and they have to form the writing surface first, and they have to then execute the writing task, which is a brief task. You can't write a lot on a quarter of a pound of clay. Mm-hmm. And then they have to do any editing or correcting and so on. Then they have to write a paper in a traditional technology, showing how writing in this old technology kind of foregrounds a lot of the stuff that goes on with writing that has just become so automatic with us that we don't think about it. Like, you know, we don't prepare our writing surfaces. We grab a piece of paper, we load the printer, we, you know, go across to the bookstore and buy a ream of this stuff. It's been pre-prepared for us. We're not, you know, scraping animal skins and drying them. We're not preparing our own inks. We're not grinding colors and mixing them with liquids to create an ink. And things like that. And we've automated the correction process. We can use the backspace key or the eraser. They have to figure out how to make a correction on a piece of clay. We know, you know, how much can go on a piece of paper or how much a screen full of text is. They have to estimate what they can put on this piece of clay. I give them the option of getting a second stick of clay, but almost no one chooses that option because that's more work.
Well, I guess that raises the question, if you have to go through all of that mm-hmm. process
yeah.
before you even begin.
There's a learning curve.
And does it, I suppose that again, it means it's a sort of there's some specialized
skills. It's user-unfriendly. You have to learn them. You have to acquire the materials, prepare the materials. It makes writing a whole big, you know.
And does that encourage more...
As we say in French, hazarai.
What? Does that then, you know, encourage some greater reverence for the process or the product?
This is one of the worries about the new technology. Yeah. The critics say, well, there. Yeah, if you, you know, no pain, no gain, kind of thing. Well, I don't know. I just don't think you have to put writers through all that prep work necessarily to get good text out the other end.
Is it now? I'm assuming that now, when your students write for you, they write the papers on their computers.
Yes.
They email them to you.
Me. I comment on using the comment utility on the word processor, and I write the comments in the margins that way, and I write an end comment, and I email the paper back.
And do they ever get printed out?
I don't print them out. If the kids print them out as a kind of backup, the students, I'm sorry, they'll always be kids to me. Yeah. I'm that old. But sometimes, you know, I a lot of the readings for some, when I teach a technology class, which I do at least once a year, all the readings for that are online, but many of the students say they print them out before they read them because they just don't like reading on screen. And they like to be able to take notes, and they don't feel that they can do this easily enough on screen. I think we're doing a lot of reading on screen, but I think there are still a lot of things that we prefer not to read on screen. So we write at the keyboard all the time. We read on screen more selectively.
Very quickly, let's get one more caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I was getting back to the pencil and handwriting versus typewriting.
Mm-hmm.
My 16-year-old son cannot read the 3-4 sentence paragraph that his grandmother writes mm-hmm. on his birthday card in mm-hmm. script. I have to translate that. He can read my printing if I write a note to him and stick it on the bathroom mirror.
Right.
But script simply cannot read it.
The lost art of handwriting. That's the other complaint. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad? We don't need to have handwriting anymore. We just don't need it. We haven't.
Thank you so much.
We haven't needed it since the typewriter became the major office tool. And so the requirement for people to have a uniform, legible handwriting went out the window once the typewriter came on the scene. We've got some discussion in schools now about whether or what kind of handwriting should be taught. Some people are sorry to see, have a sense that handwriting is sort of calligraphic, has artistic merit, shows personal personality traits and things like that, and they're sad to see it go. Other people say it's just not practical anymore. And so, one of the byproducts of that is we're not used to reading handwritten text. Not only, I mean, my handwriting was never any good, and it's worse now that I keyboard.
Mine too.
I don't read much handwritten stuff anymore, but I still can because my graduate school training was in medieval literature, so I read a lot of manuscripts. And so student handwriting is not a particular problem for me, but I can see that for many people it will be.
We're going to have to stop,
yes.
I'm sorry to say. There's much more, many interesting things in the book we've talked about. So take a look at A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution, published by the Oxford University Press, by our guest, Dennis Barron, professor of English and Linguistics here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. You also could look at his blog.
The Web of Language.
The Web of Language.
Google it. It's there.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, David.
The program today, in fact, all of today's programs made possible with support from the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, educating consumers about their rights as patients since 1977. The Healthcare Consumers is a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll deduction at work on the web at cs-il.org. WILL programs also made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra presenting Old Friends and New Faces Saturday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts. Paul Vermeil will be the guest conductor and is joined by cellist Dmitry Kuzov. This is WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine and the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will talk with writer Catherine Russell Rich about her latest book, Dreaming in Hindi, Coming Awake in Another Language. We'll talk with her about the transformative powers of language. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat is trading at 482 and three quarters, down 7. March, 499, down 6.5. Chicago December wheat, 465 and three quarters, down 8.25. March, 484 and a quarter, down 9. December corn, 363 and three quarters, down 1/4. March, 375.5, down 3/4. May, 383.5, down 1.25. July, 391.5, down 3/4. November soybeans, 956.5, up 20.5. January, 959.5, up 20.25. March, 959.75, up 19. May, 956.5, up 17.25. July, 955.25, up 15.75. October meal, 306.70, up $4. October oil, 34.80, up 52. October live cattle, 82.65, up 77.5. December, 85.02.5, up 70. October feeder cattle, 94.40, up 42.5. November feeder cattle, 94.35, up 55. October lean hogs, 50.95. That kind